Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Metal Hammer podcast. It is episode 160. I am Mel from Metal Hammer. Thanks for joining us. As always, we appreciate it. Thank you also to the Conjurer guys for providing the amazing theme tune that you heard at the start of the show. They did that for us a couple of weeks back, and I'm absolutely loving it. Go listen to Conjurer if you don't listen to Conjurer. Why would you not be listening to them? One of the best bands in the UK right now. Joining me on the podcast today is the one and only Eleanor Goodman, Deputy Editor of Metal Hammer. How are you doing, Elle? Enjoying the lovely weather?
I am very well, Merle. Loving the sunshine. It's total ice cream weather. How are you doing?
It's true. Ice cream weather's back. I'm good, thank you. Joining me also today is the one and only Stephen Hill, one of the most beautiful contributors on Metal Hammer.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's very nice of you. I'm good, thanks. I mean, you didn't actually ask whether I was good or not, but I am, so that's good. I was just trying, actually. This is not very good for the podcast listeners, but my cat's just walked in. I was going to try and grab her for Eleanor, because I know you like to see her, don't you, Elle?
Bonjour, Cam.
I love to see Bonjour.
Tantalisingly out of reach. She's just lying on the carpet, but she's too far away because I've got my headphones in. So, unfortunately, maybe she'll stay there and we'll do it afterwards. So it'll be a little post-podcast treat for both of you.
We'll record Bonjour Like Meowing or something and put it on a Patreon or something like that. That's how this works these days, isn't it? Good. I get technology. We are doing a reader Q&A special this week. We do these every so often on the Metal Hammer podcast. If you want to get involved in the next one, go over to facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers. It's where all the most dedicated readers of the magazine and listeners of the podcast all hang out. It's where we like to hang out as well. So we all talk about lots of stuff. There's been lots of interesting debates going on this week, some of which I've actually kind of snuck into the questions because I thought one of them was really interesting. One of the points that kind of got raised in general was so interesting this week that I thought we should talk about it on the pod as well. It's where you should come hang out to talk to us and let us know what you're thinking of what we're doing at Hammer, what you'd like to see more of, what you'd like to see less of, all that good stuff. You know how it works. But it is facebook.com/Metal Hammer Readers if you want to get involved, because we'll be doing another one of these in the next few weeks or so for sure. So we just get stuck in? I thought it was kind of obvious what we wanted to start with for this week. So do you want to take the first question, Elle? Big news. Big reunion news.
This is from Mark Baker. How great is the news that Mudvayne are reforming? Do they get unfairly lumped in with the crud of new metal? Or were they really the aggressive version of Tool that they seemed to aim for?
I'm fascinated by both your answers to this. Before we really get into Mudvayne in general, the Tool comparison, interesting. Probably the two biggest Tool fans at the magazine in front of me right now. What are you saying about this Mudvayne were an aggressive version of Tool vibe from Mark? Dead silence. That's a good sign.
I don't think they could be compared to Tool at all, but I think what he's getting at is the rhythmical parts of Tool. And Mudvayne have some of those kind of more interesting rhythms on there, but in terms of subject matter and composition, I'd say they're pretty different.
Yeah, I get it. I think they've probably got more to do with Tool than they have with Slipknot, to be perfectly honest, musically. The whole should they be lumped in with the crud of new metal, I don't really think they've got very much to do with new metal at all. I think it's quite a stretch to compare pretty much any band to Tool, really. Like, I think I can definitely see why someone would think that about Mudvayne. I think Mudvayne were pretty unfairly maligned, let's be honest, because of when they came out and the way they looked, really. And I guess their association with Sean Crayon as well, a little bit at the time. People sort of seemed to look at them as a sort of budget Slipknot at the time when Slipknot were more of a new metal band. I don't really strictly think they really ever were a new metal band. I mean, there's certainly odd time signature progressive elements to LD50. I think you need a bit more than that to be Tool, frankly. But yeah, like Eleanor says, I think subject matter wise and composition wise and just the whole general aesthetic of the band, it's not an obvious fit to compare those two bands. But I do think there are probably far more similarities with Tool and Mudvayne than there are with, like, I don't know, the fucking Union Underground and Mudvayne, personally.
I think the guitar tone is really new metal. Like, if you're, I think you kind of said they don't really have much in common, but I think that tone of how they sound when they riff is really new metal. But yeah, like looking back on it, when you think about what else was around all the time, with the kind of rhythms they were using and the sort of slightly jazz type things that I was trying to do, and it's more diverse than I remembered it being. I think at the time I was just like, this is a new metal band, but there's more in that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's interesting because I think one of the reasons I love kind of new metal in terms of like the culture and the era is because, I mean, I suppose this could apply, I don't know, like I don't feel like there were loads of like non-thrash bands that would have got lumped in with thrash. Do you know what I mean? When thrash kind of really broke for the first time. I guess it did kind of happen with grunge. You always like get people that aren't happy with Alice in Chains getting there with a grunge band and all that kind of thing. But because new metal as a movement, I mean, once it got past Korn, pretty much a lot of stuff that came after Korn was already kind of a bastardized version of it, or a more extreme version of it, or a more cartoonish version of it. That the whole kind of net of what new metal as a movement encompassed just got so big that, yeah, I totally agree that maybe musically it would be silly to try and compare like Mudvayne to POD, but as part of the scene and the time, they were like an iconic band. Like if you had any kind of involvement with new metal, like even now I know people who had never heard of like Edema or Taproot. They don't know those kind of one-hit wonder band, but everyone remembers Mudvayne. Like they were on Nevermind the Buzzcocks. They played that Dig video and stuff. Like it was so huge at the time. So I do get why it's kind of lumped in with that world. But I think just the sheer ferocity of the response to them reuniting, which to be honest is like shocked me actually, shows you just how much more they were maybe considered at the time, and maybe how much more their legacy have grown since they've not been around. Because as much as I think it's generally accepted that LD50 is a great album, and you know they weren't a fucking one-hit wonder band or anything like that, I still wasn't expecting them to kind of get the response that they've got. I mean, they've been booked to headline a festival, a DWP festival in the States called Incarceration, which is in Ohio, and the other two headliners are Slipknot and Rob Zombie, and Mudvayne are headlining the Saturday night of that festival. Like,
can't get my head around that.
I didn't know they were headlining that. Jesus.
Yeah. Look, here's the poster, Steve. There it is.
Holy shit.
Do you think that it's one of those things where there's a disparity that we didn't know about between the UK metal scene and the US metal scene? Did their later albums get a lot of rock radio play or something? Because here I had a copy of LD50. I think it was actually like one someone had burned for me. And I remember listening to that like a lot with my friends, but I never followed them. I just kind of listened to that record and didn't listen to the others. I think the last one was in like 2009 or something. Did they kind of fizzle out here but carry on in America? Are they more missed over there than they are here?
I'm just looking, and their album from 2005 called Lost and Found went to number 87 on the UK album chart and number 2 on the UK and on the US Billboard 200. Which is pretty amazing. And the one after that, by the looks of things, is called The New Game. And that peaked at number 15 in the US, didn't chart in the UK at all. And their final studio album, their self-titled album from 2009, that reached number 53 on the US Billboard. So it's a bit of a drop-off in like a four-year period. But didn't chart at all in the UK and only charted in the US. So obviously they were clearly a lot bigger in the US, even towards the, you know, the kind of latter part of their career than they were anywhere else.
Yeah, it seems that way. And like you look at those streaming stats and you see that like, this has all got a bit number wang, but you see that like, you know, you go to someone and go, what do you think the most popular Mudvayne song is? And everyone would say Dig, obviously. It's got about half the number of streams of the most popular song, which is Happy off that 2005 album. And I've tried to look at why it's got nearly 100 million streams. And I've tried to kind of look at why this song out of all the songs is so big. I mean, it was used as a WWE theme. It's been used Pharrell in commercials Williams. And stuff. Pharrell Williams.
Pharrell Williams. It's a hat, isn't it? That's the song you're talking about?
No, obviously not.
I love that song. It's a song for a happy day.
No,
I can't be doing with that tune. That's when Pharrell jumped the shark for me. And that got on the, yeah, that was the number one on the US Billboard Hot Mainstream Rock Tracks. Oh, how many fucking Billboard Rock things are
there? They got loads. Too many.
But yeah, anyway, the point is they're obviously a big, big deal. And this is a really big thing in the States. And, you know, I think I was saying to Steve actually a few months ago that I didn't actually own LD50. I remember playing it round at least a couple of mates' houses. So it was like, it was kind of always in my peripheral when it came out. And obviously Dig was all over the video channels and stuff. But I wasn't like a diehard Mudvayne fan at all compared to some of the other new metal era bands I really went for. But this kind of excitement around them coming back is actually quite infectious. And seeing them announced for that lineup did kind of make me think, yeah, actually, I wouldn't mind seeing quite a lot of LD50 tracks live in front of a headliner-sized crowd. I think that would be amazing. So, I mean, I think it's cool. It's unexpected. I'm going to be fascinated to see if they feel like they need to dress up like Mint Humbugs and Strawberries again, because some of that makeup I don't think looked good at the time, let alone now. I know they kind of ditched it quite early on in their career, but for a lot of people, like, that is Mudvayne. So I don't know. Are we interested to see how it all goes down?
The thing is that, I mean, I was talking about this the other day. Like, it just everything comes back round. Everything comes back round and becomes reappraised and cool at some point. I think I said it on this show last week. Like, you know, every single thing. I was looking at the reviews randomly. I was looking at the reviews for the first Tears for Fears album. And Tears for Fears, now everyone thinks, oh, they're this massive band in the 80s that everybody loved. But when, at the time, they're reviewed with terrible, terrible reviews. And I think, like, Limp Bizkit have never been cooler than they are now.
Oh, I was looking at the streaming numbers for Limp Bizkit. It's more than basically every other metal band you can think of apart from Metallica. And they've not released a record in, like, a decade or something.
I never thought I'd see a day where people were kind of, like, actually repping for Limp Bizkit as a, not just a fun band, I think that's, you know, but actually like a kind of cool, credible band. And I feel like there are a whole load of people who are like, no, Limp Bizkit are genuinely amazing. And, you know,
I always felt like that, Steve.
I think we're kind of probably three outliers in that we probably like them pretty much the whole time.
I feel very vindicated by the new metal love that's coming through.
But everything will be like, people are going to be talking about Attila. I think I said it before. People are going to be talking about Attila like they're some classic band or something in a few years. It's going to happen.
Probably.
I'm just going to ignore that.
But I think it's just the way people are consuming music now as well, because I think it's not just kind of nostalgia freaks in their 30s and 40s that are kind of pushing the new metal bandwagon back up the hill. I think, like, there's so many kids that are kind of digesting music in different ways now, and you're seeing through things like TikTok and everything else, you're seeing songs like Last Resort, for instance, just get a completely new lease of life on there, to the extent where, like, Papa Roach are doing, admittedly an awful but nonetheless are doing a kind of new TikTok friendly version of Last Resort and all this kind of stuff. Like, pop culture is kind of eating itself before our eyes, and it's just a really fascinating thing to see. I mean, and if, you know, man, if it makes, like, Limp Bizkit want to tour one more time and play the hits live, I'm totally fine with that. I know nostalgia is a dangerous and toxic thing, but, you know, who cares?
I like that Jerris Johnson version. The Jerris Johnson version of Last Resort, I think that's good. But Papa Roach's streaming numbers are huge as well, although they are an active band, so maybe that's more reason for it to be that way.
Yeah, although I strongly suggest, I strongly think a lot of that probably is to do with, like, 200 million people streaming Last Resort or whatever it is. But yeah, they are definitely doing all right as well in this whole thing. Speaking of nostalgia, going to take us all the way back to the old golden year of 2020 for this next question. David Inglis asks, first of all, he says, hi, I hope you're all keeping well. Thanks, Dave, you too. He says, what are some of the metal albums and songs from 2020 that you're still regularly listening to just now? This is a good question, because obviously we get to December in our job and you kind of make a big song and dance about the albums of the year and you're celebrating all those records, and, you know, the new year starts, you're listening to new stuff again, and, like, sometimes things fall by the wayside. And it did make me think, actually, what am I still listening to from my kind of end of year list? And I had to kind of go through it and remind myself. So I don't know. What have you been listening to, Elf, from last year?
Bring Me the Horizon, post-human survival horror. There's just a ton of bangers on there. It just doesn't get old for me. Just really, really like that record.
I've actually probably listened to that more this year than last year, you know? Like it.
And we weren't allowed that in our end of year lists either, were we? Because it's technically an EP.
I guess so. I think it's...
I feel like I didn't have it because we weren't allowed, but I can't remember now because 2020 was a long time ago.
It really wasn't.
Also, Jonathan Holton, Chance from Another Place. That was on my end of 2020 list as well. It's just a really cool, chill record. Jonathan obviously was in Tribulation, left, I think, the end of last year. And he did a really cool thing at Roadburn Redux this weekend as well. He'd pre-recorded a video of himself that was very stylized of him all dressed up in the forest. He sang a couple of tracks from it. So that made me go back to it as well. I love Catatonia, City Burials. Again, that's quite a sort of soothing record for me. I think the ones that I've been playing from last year have either been the kind of like big fuck it ones or the feel better ones. And City Burials has a mixture. There's some really sort of metal-y ones. There's some really progressive metal-y ones. And it's just a really great record. So everyone should listen to that. And then my number one last year was Ohms by Deftones, but I actually haven't listened to it that much this year because I felt like I'd rinsed it so much. I didn't want to ruin it for myself. So I still love that record and I'm going to listen to it soon, but I've just been holding off a little bit so that I don't ruin one of my favourite records.
I haven't listened to that Deftones album at all, actually, this year. I thought it was really good. Now, Steve, you gave... Code Orange's album a 10 out of 10 this year, last year even. So is it still in regular rotation for you or have you changed your mind?
No, not at all. No, funnily enough, I was going to say, I kind of didn't want to say Code Orange because I say it all the time. And I guess people probably like, that's obvious. I knew he'd say that. And I'm sorry if you knew I was going to say that. But unfortunately, that is sort of still the album that if I'm feeling like listening to something quite sort of contemporarily heavy, I will go to. There's been a few other things. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, there's not been a lot in sort of heavy music that has really stuck with me from last year that much, if I'm being perfectly honest. I think the Aranzi Pazuzu album from last year, because it was so weird and different, it was like the first time I really got into them. I've whacked that on a few times. I think that's something incredibly unique. I mentioned J Jail last year. I'm not really sure how much that counts as metal, but I've listened to that a fair bit over the last few months because I think those songs are just really, really brilliant. The Palm Reader album, Sleepless, I listened to quite a lot as well. And the other one's Close by Ohms. You said Ohms by Deftones, but Ohms, the UK, what are they, stoner sludge metal thing? I really love that record, and that has been something which I've continually listened to. I mean, probably not, maybe not in full, but certain tracks in isolation I just think are amazing on that record. So I'd say they're probably the ones that have stuck with me the most, but really, like, Code Orange has tended to be the one that I've really gone back to a lot. I mean, there's stuff like Run the Jewels and Clipping, which I talked about last year, which I still listen to both of those albums a lot. They're both fucking amazing, but they're not metal records, are they? So
no, I mean, I was going to say the one Run the Jewels will be up there as well. The one album I've listened to the most from last year so far in 2021 wasn't a metal album either. It's still that Biffy album, which is probably my overall, probably tied with Run the Jewels for my overall album of the year across like everything last year. And I still play it all the fucking time. Yeah, I mean, I still play the Trivium album quite a lot, especially like sometimes if I want to just get fired up quickly before I'm doing something, I'll just put on Scatter in the Ashes because I just love that song so much. I still play the Gavelotech album a fair bit as well. And again, like if I just want a quick like fire up kind of track on there or track to whack on a playlist, I'll play the single off it, which I've completely forgotten. Oh, Crack of Doom. I'll just put that on really quickly. And yeah, the Code Orange album still gets regular rotation as well. But I do need to revisit some of my lists from last year because I was looking at stuff from it, like the A. Williams album, the Oceans of Slumber album. I wish I could listen to the Backwash album more, but it's not on Spotify. but I think it's on Bandcamp. She has a new album coming soon as well, Backwasher. We'll definitely talk about that when that drops. That's really exciting. So yeah, it was a good year, and those albums definitely deserve to be celebrated some more. Tom Farrow asks, the recent 100 Greatest 21st Century Songs edition, that was from a couple of months back. He wants to know, how were these songs whittled down? Was it a similar way to the albums of the year list? Also, were there any songs that just missed out? Yeah, I mean, no, it wasn't like similar to the albums of the year list, because the albums of the year list is just a straight up poll of our contributors. Everyone gets an equal kind of say on what goes in. And then the ranking is done by a point system. So it's just purely democratic. With the top 100 greatest 21st century songs, it was more like we all picked a ton in the team. We then invited our readers over on the Facebook page. I said earlier, facebook.com/metalhammerreaders. Come join in. You can actually contribute to the magazine. We got some of them to pick some. We got some people in bands to pick some as well. And then we kind of just, as a team, kind of editorialized it and kind of thought, okay, like, if you can try and be objective about this, what makes the most sense to kind of put these songs in? And it, you know, they can be quite a painstaking process in many ways, but they're also a lot of fun because obviously everyone's got slightly different perspectives on what greatness counts as in those kind of contexts. I was reading back through that issue the other day, and I think it's pretty cool if we do say so ourselves. I think Chop Suey was about as an objective choice you can get for a song like that, wouldn't you say? What do you reckon?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think we said it at the time when it went in on the list that we did. It's just it's got all the things, hasn't it? It's culturally significant. It's very, very popular. It was critically adored. It represented some sort of shift in the sound of metal. It kind of captured the zeitgeist, and it's pretty much as big and as universally popular then as now as it was back then in 2001. So I think you'd be hard pressed. It kind of ticks literally every single box that you would want that would make a song important. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, I don't really think anyone can really argue with Chop Suey. I think even the people that would argue against it, who are just being country twats, still go, wake up, grab a push up a little mic. I'm sure they still know how to do that. And I bet most people couldn't do that with their alternative pick.
Absolutely not. It's beyond iconic. What were you going to say, Al?
Just that the second part of the question, were there any songs that just missed out? There were some songs that just missed out.
A lot of songs that just missed out.
Yeah. I mean, I've got a few that I wanted to put in personally, but like Merle said, we had to try and be objective. I really wanted to put in Andrew WK's Party Hard, because I just think that's an ultimate anthem. Alice in Chains, Something from When Black Gives Way to Blue. A Perfect Circle, 36 Crazy Fists, Slit Wrist Theory, Beartooth, In Between.
I think Beartooth got in, didn't it?
I don't think it did.
I thought Beartooth got in. I might be incorrect. This is what happens because there's so, you know, you end up with a list of like 200 songs or something, and there's so much kind of like last minute swapping, like, no, we can't not put this one in, but oh, that means this one has to come out. And you know, even off the top of our heads, obviously we've got it all noted down because we're professionals, but even just thinking
Beartooth
about it.
Beartooth is not in there. I've just checked online.
No way. Well, there you go. Sorry, Caleb.
100 wasn't enough.
Probably the correct decision, I would say. But for Beartooth, Andrew WK, I think, would have been a great one. I didn't have a lot to do with the picking of it, but I think I did say to you, if you don't put One Arm Scissor in there, I'm never speaking to you again.
that was luckily that was already in there, so we're still friends. But yeah, that was kind of quite an early, that was like a first round nominee, I think, for the list. I mean, for me, it was like you could just put in. It was hard to kind of know where to set the limit for like things like nu metal one hit wonders and things like that, because there were some like massive songs from that scene, but you can't really just chuck them all in there. I think we ended up putting Halo by Soil in there because we felt like that was kind of representative of the just past initial nu metal burst. It's an iconic song, you kind of have to acknowledge some of those kind of like one-hit wonder bands in there. I know there's loads of people that be like, oh, Soil aren't a one-hit wonder, but I mean, come on, man. I think their second biggest song was like a cover of like Black Betty or something. So, yeah. So
how did we not put Alice in Chains in, though? That record was incredible.
Because I feel like
so good.
As much as that album was amazing.
Check My Brain. Like,
yeah, let's Check My Brain, Your Decision, Looking in View, Black Gives Way to Blue, which I thought you would have loved because that's the Elton John one.
that is a good tune. I mean, it's not really... Oh, Elton isn't exactly very forthcoming on that tune, but...
I can't remember how this went down. I must have argued for it and it got chucked out by somebody on the team, but I'm not sure how it happened.
Probably me. I'm quite vicious when it comes to just cutting stuff. I'm like, we haven't got time for this. Look, if it was a night... When we did the 90s list, Alice in Chains were like... there with a bullet, all right? You can't have every decade unless you're Iron Maiden. But Steve, do you want to do the next question?
Yeah, sure I do. Hold on, let me get it up. I wasn't ready to go then. So Jatinder J. Tor asks, I've been listening to a lot of new bands from a rising empire and it feels like the golden era of Roadrunner in the early 2000s. Golden era of Roadrunner was 93 to 98, by the way, but anyway, do you think record labels, especially from the metal world, can have that glory again?
No. No, I mean, it's it's interesting because I think Rising Empire is, you know, it's a cool label. It's generally poised as like a kind of younger metal label. I did have to kind of just go back and check which bands are on their label because I couldn't name loads off the top of my head, and they got some interesting acts like Annie Is Okay and Heart of a Cow, the Landmarks, and bands like that. I mean, like, in terms of like labels coming out with cutting edge, exciting, vital, young, heavy bands, then yeah, like, we're in a great period for that right now. I mean, Roadrunner are probably having their best era for a couple of decades in terms of putting out great young bands. Everyone from Code Orange to Creeper to whoever, like, they've just got a fucking great roster. What's the label who came out of the ashes of Holyrood? Church Road. Yeah, Church Road, they've got a fantastic kind of, they're doing some great things as well. Nuclear Blast are signing a lot of great young bands along with the a kind of unbelievable roster of more veteran bands they've got. So I think in terms of like, you know, just a record label putting out great, exciting new bands, it's as good now as it's ever been on that front. But in terms of like being like a powerhouse, kind of chart dominating, countercultural defining force, I don't know. I feel like metal's not at that point right now. Maybe it could get there again, but I think, you know, it's going to take more than Architects kind of having to basically initiate an entire campaign around getting them on one album for us to kind of feel like metal is in that kind of space again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think there's some really great labels. Like, I mean, Southern Lords do amazing kind of doom stuff. There's an album coming out this week, actually, by Big Brave on that label, which is fucking amazing, which is out today or Friday as you listen to this podcast, which is fantastic, and they do lots of really cool kind of sludgy shit. Amazing. And you know, Jacob Bannon and what he's done with Death Wish is kind of turned it into a brand as well. And you mentioned Church Road, like, there's loads of really cool records for really cool record labels for specific types of stuff if you are into a really, really specific type of stuff. But in terms of, yeah, that kind of glory period for Roadrunner, which I'm sorry, is definitely the early to mid 90s. It's not the early 2000s. I think them having Machine Head, Sepultura, Slipknot, Vision of Disorder, Shelter, Dog Eat Dog, Biohazard, and Obituary and Deicide is a bit better than when they had like Downer and Chimera. Like, come on.
I think you find they signed Nickelback at the end of the 90s. So
right, yeah, okay. Which
Trivium?
Sales wise, yeah, but that was, yeah.
I mean, they did have, you know, they had Trivium and Slipknot and Machine Head and Killswitch Engage, and you know, so like the early 2000s had a lot to say for itself in Roadrunner Land. But I know what you mean. The label kind of defined its legacy in the 90s, I guess.
Yeah, but I think if you're somebody who got into metal in the early 2000s, Roadrunner was still massive for you, so you might not have known about all that other stuff from the 90s.
Maybe, but I mean, undoubtedly, that is the glory period, right?
I think there's probably a fairly objective argument there. Although my favourite
Type of Negative as well,
Roadrunner album ever probably is Alive or Just Breathing, and that's from 2002. So what do I know?
Let's just say they enjoyed success in the 90s and the 2000s.
And the 2010s. And the 2020s. Hooray for Roadrunner.
They've been really good, like, recently. But, yeah, I don't think the idea of one label having... I mean, you know, let's take that success of Roadrunner at that time when Chaos AD, Bloody Kisses, Burn My Eyes all came out within, you know, River Runs Red by Life of Agony, all kind of came out within a like 18-month period of each other. And, you know, they were the big, like every fucking band you saw pretty much in that period, with the exception of Pantera, who were like exciting contemporary metal bands, Fear Factory and Biohazard as well, like the ones that people were really looking at a lot, pretty much everybody was on Roadrunner, pretty much.
Yeah, fair point. They were and have been an absolute powerhouse. Do you want to do the next question, Elle?
Yeah, sure. Kevin Rowan says, I first got into System of a Down through the film Pets at Home. Bounce from the poodle scene. Which bands have got you... Which bands... This I fucked this up, haven't I? I have to start again. Which bands have you first got into through a TV or film soundtrack?
So I love think, the first idea of all, that... Sorry, go on.
I was going to say, I think, first of all, the film isn't called Pets at Home. It's called The Secret Life of Pets. And I know that because I went to see it at the cinema on my birthday and I forgot my glasses and I had to wear my sunglasses in there.
That's an unexpected aside. I just love the idea that someone... This shows you how it's so easy to just take for granted that, you know, everyone knows who System of a Down are. Everyone's heard System of a Down. You know, we were talking about Chop Suey being such an iconic song, blah, 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 blah. I love the idea that someone was watching Secret Life of Pets and heard Bounce and just went, what the fuck's this? Like, of all the places to get into System of a Down, like, I would have not have expected that in, like, 2001. Do you know what I mean?
I love that they put that in the film as well, that the dog's just really into metal and when their owner goes away, they're just like, yeah, System of a Down.
I've not actually seen the film. Is it actually all right?
I wanted to see it just because I like cute animals, but it's not a Pixar film, so there's no emotional push. It's just some cute animals on an adventure, which is fine, but there's no layers to it at all. It's quite superficial. Well, but it's got a System of a Down in it, so it's fine.
10 out of 10. Have you ever got into a band from a film? Or, I really struggle with this question, actually. I've got an answer, but it's something I've talked about before.
Well, I tell you what.
I think mine's obvious.
Go on.
You sure you want to hear it?
Is it The Crow?
Mine's obvious. No, it wasn't The Crow, actually. I think I was into a lot of the stuff on The Crow before I saw The Crow. All I was going to say, really, was the same thing applies to something like Queen of the Damned, which I'm obsessed with. And I was into Korn, Disturbed, Static X, etc. But there was other stuff on the soundtrack that I'd never heard. One of those bands was Kidney Thieves. They had the song Before I'm Dead. And they're still a band now. It says on Facebook that they're working on something new, which is quite cool as well. I think the last record was 2016. And there was another band on there called Dry Cell, which I thought were really cool. But they only had one record in 2002 that was signed to Warner's. And they were signed by Jeff Blue, who signed Linkin Park. But nothing ever happened. I'm pretty gutted about that. I thought they were a good new metal band.
A rarity, to be fair. Yeah, I've got a couple. So I don't know if either of them really count, because I feel like I would have got into these bands anyway, but I think it was the first time I heard them. So The Crow City of Angels, the pretty awful follow-up to The Crow. I went to the cinema to see that, and there's a scene where Deftones are playing Teething. So I was like, wow, this is great. And then Teething is on The Crow City of Angels soundtrack. And then I went and bought Adrenaline after that. I think I probably would have bought Adrenaline anyway, because Chino was then on Life is Peachy by Korn as well, so it sort of felt like a kind of, if you compartmentalise that, that was all helping to get me into Deftones. So there's that. Also, the first time I ever heard Lamb of God, I went to the cinema to see Metal, A Headbanger's Journey. You know that documentary? The Banger, yeah. Films one? Really, really good. And the first song they played is on it, when it sort of kicks off, is Laid to Rest by Lamb of God. And it was the first time I'd heard Lamb of God. Because this would have been like 2004, so it wouldn't have been, I think it was just as as the Palace's Burn was coming out. So it's, yeah, 2004, 2005. And I remember being like, "What? Wow, this song's fucking awesome." And waiting till the credits at the end to go, who was that? And that's kind of what made me go out and buy it. I think I bought As the Palaces Burn and I got Sacrament on import just because I was like, of that song. So Lamb of God and Deftones. If only they were as big as, what are the other ones out? Dead Cell and the Pony Fuckers or something.
No, Kidney Thieves. Where did you get Pony Fuckers from? Only ponies should fuck other ponies.
That's a good phrase to live by.
True.
I don't know if I've ever actually got into a metal band from a soundtrack, to be honest. The only thing I can compare to is the thing I've talked about loads of times, so sorry, but is, I mean, I guess if WWE can count as a TV show, then the theme tunes on it can count as its soundtrack. And so therefore, Undertaker having Rollin' for his theme song, that basically got me into Limp Bizkit and therefore basically got me into metal in a big way. So I feel like that kind of counts. Am I allowed that?
You've got Drowning Pool tattooed on your neck as well, haven't you? Because they were used on the Armageddon or something.
On ECW, yeah, that's right. I've got David Draymond tattooed on my back because he did that, Disturbed did that Stone Cold cover. In 2001.
I would love it if you did. That would be so good.
Could you imagine? Never. So yeah, my answer's crap. Sorry, Kevin. I might go watch Secret Life of Pets though after that. Scott Satumpool says, what fantasy world would you live in if you could? And he says he'd love to live in Middle Earth. Bit elfy for me, that.
I thought that was a good choice.
A bit elfy. Oh, a bit elfy, isn't it? Oh, not for me. Too many elves.
I thought it was a good shout from though. Scott. Why are you two just losing it?
Going to look at a house. What's the neighbourhood like? Any elves? There's a couple of elves. Nah. Two. I like the house. I thought you loved the house. I do love the house, but... too elfy. Not for me, thank you.
Why are you looking in Rivendell then?
yeah. What's wrong with elves?
Nothing. They're just a bit stuck up, aren't they? They're a bit stuck up. There's something a little bit, I don't know.
So arrogant, aren't they? Just because they're short.
They are a bit wanky. Like, Legolas is comfortably the lamest member of the Fellowship. Anyway, Scott would live in Middle Earth. I wouldn't. Where would you live, Hel? Where would you live in fantasy land? In your brain.
Oh, I think you can guess mine.
Under the sea?
I would live in... well, it's a fantasy world, so I didn't pick as specific a place as Rivendell, but I picked the Witcher world.
That was very telling by where your brain was at in picking that out. I would live in the Witcher's world.
I would live in the Witcher world.
Why would you want to share the worlds with a topless Henry Cavill, Elle?
If I happened to bump into Geralt, that would be totally fine. And if I was one of the priestesses at the temple, or if he was having a bath and he was there, that would also be fine.
I've weirdly just started playing The Witcher 3 on my Switch. Cool. It's obviously been out for years, but I finished Breath of the Wild. Another good fantasy game and world. The other month, and I wanted someone else, and my mate let me The Witcher 3. So, once I completed it, I might even go and watch the Netflix show, so I can have a fucking clue what's going on.
Well, I love the Netflix show, and I've just started reading the books. There's about 10 of them. I'm on the first one.
Oh, how is it? Because I was thinking about the books because they're translated, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a Polish author, and really enjoying it so far. Just really fun books, and I think because I've seen the TV show, then it's very easy to imagine the character of Geralt.
Steve, what would your fantasy world you live in be?
I don't know about this shit, do I? Fuck's sake. Fantasy worlds? I don't know.
I thought you were going to say something like funny, like, oh, I live in a fantasy world where metalheads are nice to each other or something like that.
Well, that wouldn't be very funny at all, would it? So that's
Or realistic.
No, all realistic. What's the 80s place in Grand Theft Auto there?
Vice City?
Yeah.
So you want to live in Miami in the 80s?
No elves.
No. No. I'm going to get myself a nice electric pink jacket, roll the sleeves up, get a sort of crisp white t-shirt, a big gold chain.
Jump on your moped.
Get on my moped. And, yeah, just have a few beers, I reckon. Sounds better than whatever your shit you two have fucking gone about, walking through bloody fields and up mountains in the snow. Fuck that.
Well, I haven't given mine yet.
Well, I know what you're going to say. Some shit like that, innit?
Yeah, I'd be in Discworld. So
harsh.
So I'd probably be in Discworld. I mean, Middle Earth would be cool, but all that Sauron stuff would be quite stressful. So I'd probably stay in Discworld where you've got more interesting characters and... yeah, it's funnier. And
what's Discworld?
Terry Pratchett. Terry Pratchett's kind of main series. It's like Lord of the Rings, but kind of quite funny as well. Like very funny books. I love Terry Pratchett stuff. I might even restart them again soon because they were amazing. So that's what
I feel like that question was not really for me.
Well, it could have been if you've been creative with it.
I was creative with it.
All right then, since you're such a lad, you do the next question instead.
Kimberly Burrows asks, let's talk banned beverages. Which is your favourite? Which ones haven't you tried yet and would like to? Candlemass recently released their two flavoured shots of doom that I'm dying to try. In Solitude Violet Licorice and Gallows Salty Licorice. If you could invent your own banned beverage based on a song, what would it be? Oh, more inventing things. God.
Being creative.
Yeah, God, I hate it. I'll tell you what's lovely, and I'm going to shout out because they're friends of mine. Signature Brews Christmas ale that they did with, it's like a bitter that they did with the Darkness at the end of last year.
That is actually really nice.
That is fucking lovely,
That is a good beer.
Signaturebrew.co.uk, go and get your...
Yeah, all right, they don't sponsor this podcast.
Though. Oh, right, I was getting mixed up.
I lived off quite a lot of the Motorhead beers over the first lockdown, as well as Signature, actually. There are a few breweries that I just kind of take it in turns to like order in for the weekend each time because obviously all the pubs were closed. And I went through a lot of those Motorhead beers and they're really good. I like the Metallica beer as well, although it is deceptively strong. It's like nearly 6%. So you have a few of them, you'll get knocked out. I like the Metallica whiskey, even though it basically just tastes like Jack Daniels, but that's a win in my book. And I do like some of the Trooper beers as well, although not so much the super ale-y ones. But there are a couple of nice ones as well. I was trying to think of bands that should do a beer and haven't done a beer yet. I don't think Orange Goblin have done a beer, have they? Because Ben Ward would get... I reckon he'd smash making a good beer. That man knows his way around a pint.
They haven't done... I don't know. Maybe they haven't. I don't know. But that seems like something that they should do,
They should do it. They can call it Red Brew Rising and give it some kind of red tint. That would be my choice. And I would enjoy it very much. So let's do it. Let's do it, Orange Goblin. Orange Goblin time Metal Hammer beer. Made by Signature Brewery. There we go. Let's make it happen. What about you, Elle? What's your favourite band brew?
I've got the Slipknot Bourbon, which is okay. It's got a cool logo on the front that's like corn from the cornfields of Iowa. Got it for Christmas, so that's quite cool. I really want to try the Clown Moonshine, but it's only available in the US.
I've never had
moonshine. They're doing some kind of special box set where you get the bourbon and the moonshine together, but you can't buy the moonshine by itself. But I just feel like moonshine made by Clown would be weird and intense.
I've never actually had moonshine, so I wouldn't know. Is it not like quite hardcore, that stuff?
Yeah, it just tastes... Well, I've had stuff, yeah, that's called shine or moonshine before, and it just tastes like pure alcohol. It just kind of tastes like... just tastes like alcohol.
Delicious.
I think they should make an Oasis moonshine and call it moonshine, and it'd be like just a sort of weaker version of the Beatles one that they already had sort of 40 years ago.
That's quite good. I'd drink that.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, it had to be like 3%, and you can only drink it warm in a field at a festival. God, I'm so starved of live music and stuff that actually made me feel a bit nostalgic. What's
going on? Mate, I'd love it. Wouldn't you love it? At the moment, I'd have a Tuborg in a paper cup.
Yeah. Everyone keeps saying that right now. It keeps coming up, Tuborg, because it's the quintessential warm beer.
What are Tuborg doing?
Huh?
What's Tuborg doing? I've literally haven't seen that beer brand. Do they like do beers you can buy in shops or?
Yeah.
You can get a pint. You can buy a pint of Tuborg at certain pubs, I'm sure.
I've never seen that. I would like to see the pub that does that.
You could do an Iron Maiden moonshine.
I call it
what?
And
you could call it Moonshine Child.
That's so bad.
Good.
Moonshine Child. No.
Or you could just call it Moonchild.
Come on, Bark.
Still has the word moon in it.
Surely it's Bark at the Moonshine by Ozzy Osbourne. Come on.
Yeah.
Come on, you'd buy that, wouldn't you?
Or an REM one, if you can you believe they put a man on the moonshine?
Mate, I got REM's greatest hits on vinyl the other week. For a fucking band.
Ah,
a band.
Amazing.
Phenomenal. I like Bark at the Moonshine because it could come with some kind of dog.
A werewolf.
Oh, get over animals.
Oh,
Jesus.
Sorry.
Get over animals. Pathetic. Daniel Pleites. Right, this is a serious question now. We can get our critical heads back on. Daniel Pleites says, why do people hate on Ghost, Poppy and Baby Metal? Isn't it good for metal that artists or groups from the past decade are gaining more and more momentum? Why do people hate these bands, Elle? And should they shut up?
Well, people are very protective of their nostalgia and of their bands and of their genres. And then bands like Ghost and Poppy and Baby Metal come in and people say, that's not metal, that's something else, we don't like it. But I just feel like it happens with every single generation of bands. And I think it is good that artists and groups are kind of, well, people are bringing metal into sort of newer, more different times. But I think it's almost like a challenge to metal as well, isn't it? If you've got bands that aren't strictly in the metal scene, I mean, Ghost and Baby Metal are definitely in our world. Poppy's on the edge of our world, maybe should be in our world. But I think if you've got bands that are getting more mainstream attention and that are getting a lot of traction, then maybe if you're a traditional metal band, you need to be looking at it and going, we can't do the same thing for years and years and years. Let's do something new. But I don't really know what I'm talking about because there's tons of innovative bands out right now. It's just that they're not getting as much... they're just not doing as well commercially, are they, I suppose? So it's like Poppy and Baby Metal are doing better commercially than some really amazing bands that are still kind of more niche or underground. Don't know, I've lost my train of thought.
It's fine. Let's get it back on track. It's weird, isn't it? Because, these three bands are very different examples. I mean, there are elements of some of Poppy's songs that do sound a bit Baby Metal-ish, having said that. But, you know, Ghosts, you've got this band that were completely born in the metal underground. And whatever people think of the last album, like the last album was basically like a pop rock album, sure, but they're still rooted in metal and it was a catchy kind of Blue Oyster Cultury strain of metal. But, you know, those early gigs they were playing and those early festivals they were playing and everything else, like they came from the metal scene. It's not like they kind of came from EDM and then just went, now we're going to try and be in the metal scene now. Like the metal scene is where they came from. Baby Metal are a cultural phenomenon because we've never seen anything like that before, and they morphed metal with something so recognizable of their culture that it felt different. It kind of linked into a completely different side of the music industry and the J-pop industry. And then you've got Poppy, who is a kind of just a unique creative artist who just takes elements from basically wherever the fuck she feels like taking them from and just mashing them together, and metal is a big part of that and it's a big part of her aesthetic. So there's three different things, but I guess, like you said, Al, the only thing that really unites them is that none of them are kind of traditional hairy metal bands. Do you know what I mean?
I do get it as well, though, in a sense, because, you know, listening to you describe them all, the one thing that stands out is the fact that they are all acts. They're very much like acts. You know, Ghost have got popes and a storyline about religion. Poppy is a character. She's not actually presenting as herself. She's presenting as this other type of thing. And Baby Metal drew on idol bands, and they're all characters as well. They're not presented as real people. They're presented as the three characters of Baby Metal. So
just
very...
like Manowar and Iron Maiden and Kissing.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, or Slipknot or Marilyn Manson or Rob Zombie, you know. I mean, it's true. But...
I would argue there's like more artifice in them than some metal bands. Slipknot have got masks, and obviously that was a huge gimmick at the start, but that kind of stayed on as an aesthetic, but we know who they are as people now, and we know more about them and stuff. You could argue that there's more authenticity with bands like that, or bands who don't have some kind of strong visual image, than there are with Ghost Puppy and Baby Metal.
That's an interesting
doesn't mean it could be less good, but people might not connect with it in the same way.
I think Baby Metal is probably the outlier of the three in that sense for me, because they are, I mean, you know, the three girls, now two girls, kind of said from the start they didn't really know what metal was. They didn't have any connection with it when they started. They have, you know, they are literally a manufactured band. They are the product of an ingenious idea where someone thought, wouldn't it be great to combine J-pop and the kind of idol culture with heavy metal? And it's worked because it's done so convincingly, and it's backed by a metal band who are legit and you know what they're doing and are steeped in the history of metal. But I think
songwriters too, songwriters who came from metal.
Yes, definitely, exactly. So, but there's still probably more, I think that kind of like thing of like Artifice probably applies most to them, just because that is literally someone's just kind of manufactured that out of nothing. Whereas at least Poppy and Tobias Forge are like kind of artists who are just doing their own thing and have kind of created a persona around that. Like with Baby Metal, I feel like they kind of made a persona and then kind of injected metal into that. Whereas I feel like, Ghost and Poppy are from the minds of Poppy and Tobias Forge, and they kind of made music and have built this weird gimmick around that. I don't know. Am I making sense, Steve?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I would say the way
a little bit. Cheers.
No. You are. I mean, I think there's. I mean, it doesn't really bother me at all that like somebody who's written a song particularly, like, I don't know. I'm sure Cold Chamber wrote all their songs, but they're still not as good as the boy band Five.
I like both bands.
So who gives a fuck? Metal's fun, isn't it? Because metal will tell you that it's the most open-minded genre of music, and that it doesn't matter what you look like or what you say or what you sound like or where you're from. Everybody's welcome. And, you know, the evidence of the thing that those three bands have in common is they don't look right. They don't look like they should be metal bands. And the reason people don't like it is because, I mean, Ghost are committing the most heinous crime of the three of them, I think, of looking the least like they sound. I mean, Ghost look like they should sound like Dark Throne, and they don't. They sound like Blue Oyster Cult. And rather than just going, huh, that's funny how they sound like this kind of classic hard rock 70s thing with a bit of, you know, kind of 70s ABBA-y pop pomposity about them, rather than going like, oh, what an interesting thing to do to sort of merge that with those visuals. No, people go, oh no, I know what those bands who look like that sound like, and they don't sound like this, and the end. You know, like, that's it, you're not a metal band, you have to sound like that. And it's really, really fucking ironic that I think metal is probably the most, as a genre, is probably more than any other genre, is the one that cares the most about what you look like. I think it's really, really ironic to think that metal is this really open-minded thing, when I think, actually, if you're two young girls, you can't be metal, dressing in nice dresses. If you're some, you know, YouTuber who dresses in silver and stuff and presents herself like a kind of robotic Lady Gaga, you can't be metal because you're not dressed properly. And there are plenty of things, like Baby Metal is, when I remember when I first heard Baby Metal, it was a head fuck. Like, it was a real head fuck, because those melding of those two things is something that I'd never ever heard before. So it was a real like thing to go, oh god, that's weird. But nobody, you know, previously you wouldn't get, I mean, some people would, but you shouldn't get too bent out of shape for two types of music kind of being melded together. I don't see other genres getting annoyed about that. I don't see other genres getting angry that hip-hop has been melded with dubstep, or if, you know, folk music has been melded with electronic music. You just don't get that in other genres. You only get it in metal, and it's all down to the fact that you know, this calling people, anyone who calls someone a poser because they look like Poppy or whatever. I mean, you know, you're the one in the uniform, mate. You're the one who has to dress in black and you have to wear a battle jacket and you have to grow your hair. You're the fucking, you know, you're the one who's got the uniform. You're the one who's conforming to a set of preordained ideals. And those bands don't. And in any other genre, they wouldn't get shit, but they do in metal because lots and lots and lots of metal fans are really, really narrow-minded.
I got stuck backstage at Download by a security guard when I was trying to get into like our temporary office area one year. And I was like, oh, I'm just trying to work. Here's my pass. And he was like, oh, you don't look like a rock chick. And I was like, fuck off. Just go fuck yourself, please.
I mean, I think we probably know what he meant by that, which is not criticising anyone who chooses to look like a quote-unquote rock chick, but that's, yeah, this, it's just so presumptuous, isn't it? I mean, yeah, it's just, it's very, very odd. I think a lot of it does come down to the fact that metal has been such an outsider genre for so many years. And, okay, you can't compare it to an outsider genre like hip-hop, which is an entire cultural movement from a from an oppressed, you know, side of society. Like, it's not an underdog movement in that aspect. But it's never, even when, like, we've talked about it before, even when Limp Bizkit were number one and everything else, like, I love new metal, and I think it is absolutely a valid part of the metal world, but I wouldn't try and say that's an example of, like heavy metal being, like, the biggest thing in music. Like, heavy metal, in its purest form, has never been the kind of the number one go-to cultural touch point for music itself. And so I can understand why people that have embraced it turn to metal, because they recognize a community in it, they recognize a community of outsiders in it, and then they see people just kind of picking elements of it as they see fit without really wanting to actually engage in it. I can understand why that forms a bit of resentment, you know, like it's kind of like it does feel like a club, and it feels like if you don't know what it's like to kind of see that guy, you know, so drunk he's shitting himself at Bloodstock and screaming Slayer or whatever, like, then if you're not kind of part of that world, it does feel a bit weird when you then see like someone like Poppy, I guess, putting quartz paint on. But then how do we know that she isn't as invested in that side of it? We only don't know that, or people, I think Poppy's kind of cool. Like, people only assume that of Poppy because she's a young woman and she doesn't necessarily, you know, she's not stood there in a battle vest and an Arch Enemy t-shirt or whatever, and we kind of make these assumptions about people. But it's, I don't know, it's fucking weird.
But yeah, I mean get the fucking chip off your shoulder, like, grow up. I would say just like the fucking music you like. Like, who gives a shit? Like, who gives a shit if Poppy comes? I mean, I've had this conversation, you know, especially regarding back to Hybrid Theory, which I was like bringing up the new metal thing. I think sonically there are things, I don't think you can really listen to Poppy, particularly the heavy. I don't think Poppy has turned around and said she is a metal artist. She is a pop artist. She is a kind of a visual artist in many genres, you know. She's a YouTuber and she does all these weird kind of artsy things, and she's done some metal songs, she's done some pop songs, she's done some kind of ambient electronic stuff. She's done all kinds of things, I think, with varying degrees of quality. She's all right, like, you know, her music's perfectly fine. It's not really what I choose to listen to, but if she wants to dip her toe into metal because it's something she likes, or she wants to kind of adopt the iconography of black metal, I've got absolutely no problem with that at all. That's something that she chooses to present herself. It's not going to make me go, ah, oh, I better throw all my fucking Immortal albums away now that a young girl off YouTube likes this type of thing. Like, why do you fucking care? I do think and Ghost are the same thing. Like, just because Ghost don't sound like a black metal band, they sound like a Blue Oyster Cult. You probably wouldn't have a problem with Blue Oyster Cult. You probably wouldn't have a problem with old school 70s hard rock. So why have you got a problem with Ghost? Doesn't make sense. Baby metal, like you've already said, are really, really fucking heavy. Yes, you know, musically, they're actually really heavy, and they're actually like a metal band. They've got solos, they've got double kick drum, they've got massive fuck off polyrhythmic Meshuga style riffs. They're just fronted by, you know, two young girls who just because they're not doing George Corpse Grinder Fisher death growls, that's not the only trait of what metal is. I think for me, if musically something's being put into metal, for like when 21 Pilots were getting called a rock band, and I was like, I don't see where the through line is from you. It's not about how you dress or how you look or the people that you bring into that scene. It's the fact that I'm not, like, the stuff you're influenced by and the stuff that makes up the sonic amalgam of your music has really got nothing to do with rock music. So why are you being called a rock band? Linkin Park, when they're being called a metal band, I think Linkin Park broadly early on were a metal band, but I could see how people were like, I think the dilution of that sound is something which people really reacted weirdly to. And I am one of those people. But when you look at nu metal, like, no matter how weirdly they dressed or whatever they were doing, you know, like, there's some really fucking heavy bands that came out of nu metal. System of Down's first album in particular is really heavy. Slipknot, Iowa is really heavy. The first Korn album is really, really fucking heavy. Deftones on Around the Fur and Adrenaline, heavy, heavy bands. Like, they're much heavier than Warrant or Winger or, you know, fucking Saxon or whatever. They're sonically heavy, heavy bands. And as long as bands continue to have some kind of level of actually being sonically powerful, I honestly don't give a fuck how they fucking dress. And it's the lamest, most pathetic thing to bang on about how bad, like, the fact that, oh, I won't listen to that because that's a girl and she doesn't know about black metal. Who fucking cares? You know about it. Enjoy it. If that's what you're going to listen to, you go and enjoy it. Fucking grow up.
Isn't it that classic thing of, like, if you don't like it, then you don't have to hate on it and engage with it. You could just go, like you said, and listen to something that you do like. If you've got albums you like, that's cool. Listen to them. Leave the things you don't like for someone else.
Yeah, hard, hard agree.
Yeah, that's it.
That's it. That's it.
That's it.
No, it's true. It's with. I mean, it. I said on the Facebook earlier, like, on the Facebook group earlier this week that, like, I don't understand how someone can try and, with a straight face, say that an artist like Baby Metal doesn't belong in Metal Hammer. Like, it's ludicrous. Like, what other kind of world is going to even be able to kind of digest that whole thing and critically analyze it and everything else, if not our world, because that's where it's rooted. And it's really, really interesting. And I am a firm believer, as someone that came through my first issue of Metal Hammer, I've said it many times, I picked it up because, you know, I wanted to read about bands like Limp Bizkit. And within a few issues, I was listening to bands like At the Gates. Like for me, metal doing well on a mainstream level is good for the scene. At the very, very least, it's not going to be a bad thing for the scene, is it? Like, it's not going to make fewer people listen to metal to go see an artist like Poppy performing on NXT or whatever else. So I think it's cool that these artists are out there. I hope it continues, and I hope that, you know, we can get to a stage, like, to bring us almost full circle, that we can get to a stage where metal labels are signing major, major artists and are kind of permeating the mainstream in a zeitgeist curating way. I can't see a downside for metal for that, if that happens. So you keep on doing what you're doing, Ghost Poppy and Baby Metal, if you're listening.
And look at what happened with Kevin Rowan going to see The Secret Life of Pets and getting into System of a Down. You never know how people might get into metal bands. You just need a band or a song to just be somewhere people can find it.
Exactly.
And if metal is all underground all the time, no one is going to find it. It's exactly. It's not going to grow as much.
Imagine if someone, like, involved in that process was an actual metalhead and someone said, oh, wouldn't it be fun if you put a System of a Down song on there? And they went, no, don't put our song on there. No, don't want you to. No, we don't. No, our music doesn't go in Disney films or whatever, cartoon films. No, we don't want it. Just do a pop song. Don't care. System of a Down would have one less fan, and how gutted would they be to know that?
Yeah. It's true.
Right.
I was going to say something else then, but actually it'd just be fucking going off on one again, so I might just leave it.
Have a little stroke of bonjour.
She sat in the bathroom window looking out at the world, ready to pounce.
What a lovely image to end on. That is it for this week's show. We will be back next week. And as I said, if you want to be involved in the next reader Q&A special, we should call it a listener Q&A special as well, really, shouldn't we? Because they listen to this podcast. But if you want to be in the next Q&A special, go to facebook.com/metalhammerreaders and hang out and ask us some questions. Pick up the latest issue of Metal Hammer. You've got about another week or so to pick up that Ramstein issue before we unveil a brand new issue of Metal Hammer next week. It is all about one of the most important releases of 2021, and we are very, very excited about it. So we'll reveal that next week. In the meantime, take care of yourselves. It's goodbye from me and Steve and Elle. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.